Whether sought or unsought by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our end-of-year show, Cavalcade. It continues to cavil and cade. Is that right, Emma? Did I do that right?
Perfect grammar.
Emma Viglin is here with us as we wrap up the year, looking at some of our best of shows. We have got one of my favorite shows maybe ever. David Blight, professor emeritus of history at Yale University, one of the foremost experts on Reconstruction, and has written a biography on Frederick Douglass. We spoke to him, I don't know, a couple months ago. And you'll hear me gush about him during the interview. And I think it's before you join the show, Emma.
I think coincidentally, all of our best of shows are before I joined.
That is totally a coincidence, except for the fact, I will tell you, you joined the show in the first week of November, and we do our best of the year on like a sort of a fiscal year. For best ofs. So we actually go from November 1 to November 1. So theoretically, we could take best ofs from 2019. We didn't this year, but we could, just to make it clear that gotcha. We are maintaining our principles, as it were, about the best of series. But one of the things that I think over the past couple years, and certainly it was influenced by what this country has gone through in terms of the polarization, was I have become very interested in Reconstruction. This is the period following the Civil War into, I don't know, about 12 years following the Civil War, where there was a new opportunity for this country. In many respects, we talk about this with David Blight, this era was really, in many respects, the founding of America as we know it today, right? And the interview will explain more of that, but it's such an incredible era, and it's also incredible and how under-taught it seems to be in our education system, and how lacking it is in our consciousness as a country and as a people. And it is also a time of real missed opportunity, or perhaps stolen opportunity. And some of the things that we talk about, we're going to touch on this week, talk about that history a little bit. But I think to understand the history of this country, and to understand, you get a greater understanding of history in many respects. And you get an understanding of the 150, 60 years since the Civil War to understand this period of Reconstruction. And of course, Frederick Douglass, a major figure. So Emma, we're going to come back at the end of this interview, but we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with an interview I did with Professor Emeritus from Yale University, David Blight, right after this. One of today's sponsors is Third Love. Third Love has an online fit finder quiz that will help you find the size and styles that fit your breast size and your body. Over 16 million women have taken the quiz to date. They use the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort, all-day support. Third Love's perfect fit promise means if you don't love it, you exchange it and you return it. You do it for free, and you have 60 days to do it. 2021 is your time to shine. So focus on what makes you happy, starting with better bras and underwear. You can check out all the exclusive styles at thirdlove.com, from modern stripes to lace that actually feel soft, to their number one rated 24/7 classic t-shirt bra. Now, folks, I have an admission to make. I do not wear bras. However, you've had multiple official Third Love bra testers. And this is the response that we got from one of them. The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in. But in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online. Certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They are incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. My daughter also got some Third Love bras, and she doesn't seem to understand how this works. She keeps coming to me going like, can you get me a coupon code? I'm like, no, I already bought you bras. But she loves them. They're her favorite bra. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 10% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority right now. Find your perfect fitting bra. Get 10% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 10% off today. Also, a lot of folks at the end of the year look to give to charities. One of the ways for you to find a charity that you know will save and improve lives and do so by using as much of that dollar that you give, of every dollar you give, towards that end. Well, for over 10 years, GiveWell.org has been helping donors like you find those charities. Here's how it works. GiveWell dedicates over 20,000 hours a year researching charitable organizations. They handpick a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed charities, and they list them for you. They give you all the research. They put all of that research on their website. They do it right on there. It's free. Since 2010, GiveWell has helped over 50,000 donors direct over $500 million to the most effective charities. GiveWell never takes any fees, so all of your tax-deductible donations are given directly to the charity you choose. For me, I found GiveDirectly through GiveWell. Don't think they're related. There's a bunch of other charities there. But GiveDirectly was the one that resonated with me. It allows you to give direct cash transfers to people living in poverty. And all the data that I have read suggests that this is the most efficient way to help people in poverty is just give them money. They know how to deploy those resources the best. And so that's what I do. I use GiveWell to give directly. And here's the thing. You only have a few days left to make a tax-deductible donation before the new year. And if you go right now, when you make your first donation to GiveWell, your gift will be matched up to $250. Just go to givewell.org/majority, pick podcast and majority report at checkout. This matching offer is good only for as long as funds last. Get your first donation matched up to $250 at givewell.org/majority and select podcast and majority report at checkout. Lastly, I'll tell you right now, I know what I'm doing. It's vacation. I am sitting around my house lounging in some of my new clothes, maybe my old clothes that I got through Stitch Fix. What is Stitch Fix? Well, online shopping can be difficult. For me personally, all shopping can be difficult. I don't like to buy clothes. I don't know what clothes to buy. Stitch Fix offers clothing that is hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, your unique style, and your unique budget. It's a completely different and fun way to find clothes that you'll love to wear. It has helped me dramatically. Try on pieces at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. It's super easy. You pay a $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited toward any piece that you keep. You don't have to have a subscription. Try Stitch Fix once, or you can set up automatic deliveries. Shipping, returns, exchanges, they are super easy, super free. They give you a prepaid return envelope is included in your Stitch Fix box. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing for women, men, and kids. They ship all over the U.S., and they're available in the U.K. too. trying to remember the name of that like waffle long sleeve shirt I got there. I generally don't like white stuff, but I saw it and I was like, you know what, I'll try it on and I love it. And now I'm probably, it's probably been on vacation. I probably worn it like 5 days in a row. Also, I got a, and I tried this. This is the thing I like about it is that one, I input what kind of clothes I like, which is, you know, pretty bland clothes. That's, I mean, that's just the case. And I don't like it with the logos or anything like that. And your stylist kicks back to you clothes that fit those requirements. Sometimes they're a little bit on the edge. Maybe I don't like it. You send me a mock turtleneck, I'm sending it back. That's what I did. It was super easy. But I also picked up a lined, what they call Arlo work jacket. And I was a little bit, you know, hesitant. Like, is this a little bit too like a smoking jacket for me? Showed up. I love it. I love it. I probably should change out of it occasionally. But that's the great thing about it. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You'll get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's your box. At stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority.
The Sterling Professor of American History, the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery Resistance and Abolition at Yale University, Professor David Blight, author, his most recent anyways, is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here.
I have to tell you that I have told so many people about your course on the Civil War. It has honestly, I was just mentioning before you came on, I got about a half a dozen IMs as we announced that you were on the program today, because I've told so many people to listen to it. And it is, I cannot recommend it enough. It has really changed my perspective on the history of this country. And so I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you here. So let's start in first with Frederick Douglass, and then I want to move on to sort of like some of the that aspects. Apparently, more and more people are talking about Frederick Douglass, and this, of course, is in reference to Donald Trump. I think maybe being aware of your book in some fashion, or at least the maybe not, or the Pulitzer that was awarded to it, but. For those people who are not aware of Frederick Douglass being talked about, will you just give us sort of like the broad strokes of who he was? Because I think Frederick Douglass, I think Reconstruction, Civil War, is really undertaught in American history for some reason.
Yeah, well, it's never felt untaught to me because I've taught it all my life, but that's the bubble I live in. That comment from Trump didn't come from any knowledge of my book or, frankly, from any knowledge at all. But Douglass is a towering figure across the 19th century. He is, in many ways, the prose poet of American democracy. For those who don't know him yet, you will discover him primarily in his words. He wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography, three different autobiographies. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of short-form editorials, political editorials in his newspaper that he published for 16 years. And he wrote literally thousands of speeches. He may have been most famous in the public, at least, as an orator. And indeed, he was one of the greatest orators of the 19th century, of all of American history. But his story, of course, begins with the fact that he was born a slave. He grew up 20 years as a slave, born out on the eastern shore of Maryland. He was born in a backwater, a kind of nowhere backwater of the American Slave Society. And we really probably wouldn't even know about him had he not been sent to Baltimore for portions of those 20 years as a slave. He was first sent there to be the companion of his owner's nephew. Then he was sent back in his teens. he spent 9 of his 20 years as a slave in Baltimore, a major ocean port, a major shipbuilding city, a city with a view on the ocean and the maritime world, and a city in which he lived as a slave, but he lived amidst a very large free black community. In fact, there were more free blacks in Baltimore than there were slaves. And that has a great deal to do with how he was able to cultivate language, cultivate his oratorical skills, cultivate his reading, cultivate his interest in the Bible and in local churches, and indeed have a degree at least of physical freedom of movement around the city in his teenage years, late teenage years. But he escapes at age 20 and, you know, within only 3 years in the North, he became an itinerant orator on the abolitionist circuit, and he took it by storm. So he then becomes this figure of words, of language, of the extraordinary ability to capture first in his oratory, then later in his writing, in autobiographies, in his newspaper, and so on, this greatest American dilemma, this greatest problem in American history, the problem of slavery, race, the coming of, you know, the turbulent 1850s, the coming of disunion and civil war, his role as an interpreter in the midst of this civil war from his newspaper perch in Rochester, New York, is crucial. But then he's going to live all the way to 1895. He lives, in effect, across the whole 19th century, almost. He lived to see all of its great events, interpret its great events, and play a role in most of those great events. He's one of those rare figures who is, well, for two reasons. First, he's born out there on the Eastern Shore in 1818. This is before steamboats, before the telegraph, before the railroad, before all those elements of modernity that would so change the United States and the world. But he's going to live all the way to 1895, when, for God's sake, you can cross the Atlantic in 8 days on a steamship. They have something called a phonograph that can record voices, although almost unbelievably, his voice was never recorded that we know of. He lived to a new age, electric light bulbs. They even had the first telephones. He lives to a new age of things modern, of modernity. But the other thing is, he is one of those rarest of activists, or, you know, radical reformers, who actually lives to see his cause triumph. He lives to see his cause win in the abolition of slavery in the midst of the Civil War, and then the transformation of the United States under a new constitution. The 13th, 14th, and 15th right. Amendments to the Constitution made it a new constitution, and therefore a new republic. But he's also going to live long enough to see those triumphs all but betrayed and crushed in the post-Reconstruction South, which leads to, you know, terrorism and the Jim Crow system, which is being put in place by the time he died. So it's an epic life, and he left so much for us to conjure with as a thinker and as a writer and as a speaker. And we return to him over and over now, those who have discovered him. And we're trying to make more people do that. We return to him as a voice to help us understand, what is this thing called America? If America is an idea, what is it? What is it? If America is democracy, what does that mean? And how did it get transformed in all that slaughter of the Civil War? What was Reconstruction? What was it reconstructing? And why is race such an enduring, seemingly eternal problem in American society, whatever we say about ourselves and whatever we tell the world are our creeds? Why can we never completely solve this issue? There is so much to learn about those questions, and Douglass's confrontations with these questions 160, 150, 140 years ago that can really help us today.
There's so much that that, you know, there's moments where in his life where he says, and you talk about, you write about this, I should say, that are so reminiscent, you know, don't have the exact date, when he says that that black values lives are just not valued by white people. I mean, this is something obviously that we're hearing echoes, if not just exact echoes, still 130, 40 years later. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which I found sort of fascinating, and I didn't have any sense of this, was the relationship within him between sort of like his, I don't know how to really express this, but his radicalism and his pragmatism. And in some ways there, I go to this because I have a paucity of metaphors, but there's a quality of Lenny Bruce to his progression when he goes from being sort of and I didn't realize how sort of like renowned he was for his oratory skills, right? Yeah. Like he's what I would say, like in Lenny Bruce's sort of like early stage, he's a, you know, he's a comedian, he's a good comedian, but then at one point he starts getting much more radical and there's a lot more questions and there's that dynamic that goes on with him. And it's sort of like the pendulum swings within him throughout his life from when he says that he became a man from a slave. He becomes a slave to a man by having a physical fight.
Yeah.
Yet he, so much of what his skill set is from actually like performing and talking. You talk about that theme internal to him?
Sure. There are many contradictions and paradoxes about Douglas, which is of course one of the things that makes him so interesting. That actual passage from the original autobiography is, I've shown you how a man was made a slave. Now I will show you how a slave becomes a man. Now that comes right after he has this epic fight, this struggle with an overseer named Edward Covey, to whom he has been rented out for 9 or 10 months. And Covey beat him savagely. And Covey was a real person, by the way. Douglas isn't making that up. He's not making up Covey anyway. And that's a classic kind of male resurrection story, in the sense of he resurrects himself from despair and this constant physical beating in bondage under Covey by fighting back through his fists. Now, you don't find that story in women's slave narratives, because a woman taking on an overseer was a pretty, pretty hard thing to do, although there are some examples of it. But Douglas grew up having to fight with his fists. There's no question about that. He learned how to do that. He got the hell beat out of him in the shipyards of Baltimore more than once. In fact, he got smashed in the head with an anvil by a sailor. The white sailors sometimes resented him because they feared, you know, black kids going to take their jobs. Not a new thing. You know, he'll encounter that again, even in the North. But to your question about the radicalism and the pragmatism, it's one of the most interesting things about Douglas, because he starts out as a true radical abolitionist. No question. He's a Garrisonian, meaning he's a follower of William Lloyd Garrison. Garrison discovered him Garrison and his people, and they brought him out on the lecture circuit. They helped even support his family to a degree, especially when he went off to England for 18 months. And he was in all major ways a moral suasionist, meaning under Garrison, the strategy was to change the hearts and minds of your audiences, to appeal to their hearts and minds. And you did it with a very radical, often Old Testament biblical message, that they either come to the altar and reform or they are about to be destroyed. Now, he learns with time, not too long either, before he's even out of his 20s, that kind of approach is perhaps not going to ultimately win the day. And he becomes much more interested in politics. And in the wake of the Mexican War, and especially the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which endangers every Black person in the North now, he begins to sidle up to some degree, at least rhetorically, to the possible uses of violence. He breaks away from Garrison and begins to embrace what was known as the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution, trying to find a way to get the law on the side of abolition instead of always saying the Constitution is hopelessly complicitous with slavery. But mostly what Douglass was learning is that slavery was a gigantic moral problem, but it was also a gigantic political problem, meaning you had to find a way to fight it in the halls of power. That means automatically, you're going to have to find a way to make deals with political parties, with people who at least have sympathy, you know, toward anti-slavery. The course of the 1850s, the decade that leads up to the American Civil War, is when Douglass transforms, to a degree, from a radical abolitionist into a still radical but a pragmatic abolitionist, looking for every way possible, first, to damage this institution of slavery, and then to destroy it. And it gets him to the point where he is at least open to supporting something like the original Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln, although that's a difficult dance for him at first. But it's the prototype in American history, especially for a Black leader, who's always on the outside knocking on the door. You know, there's always the radical outsider, but is now trying to find a foothold inside of institutions, inside of a political party, and maybe even inside the government, when you can find sympathy and interest and, you know, common will with white politicians. This was never an easy thing. And the Civil War is going to solve some of these things for him, but of course, in massive bloodshed.
What struck me too about that transition, particularly that period when he returns from the British Isles after 16, 17 months, and this is in 47, I think it was, it's almost like his anger is ramped up on some level because you, as you write, like he's returning to, he's sort of tasted what a society where he is not, a part of a slave class or at least, you know, and he returns back to America and it makes him more angry, which, you know, that makes total sense. But his reaction is to become more pragmatic. Like he harnesses that rage in a way that is very productive, I guess, in some way.
It takes time, but yeah, this is where the mastery of language and the power of words are so important, because there's a lot of rage in this young Frederick Douglass in his 20s and now moving into his 30s, tremendous rage in him. But he had the great good fortune to become so adept at both speaking and writing. He had that ability to process this rage. And now he creates his own newspaper and he has to put that baby out week after week after week. As he says, I had to have something to say every week. And he did. But you're pointing to the British Isles, the first trip there of 18 months in 45 to 47. It's one of the two or three most important pivotal turning points in Douglass's life. He goes there, a young 27-year-old Garrisonian moral suasionist, never been on a steamboat before, steamship. But he is embraced first in Ireland for a month, then in Scotland, even more so, because he arrived in Scotland during one of their great ecclesiastical wars over whether to send money back to the American South that had been raised to support the new Church of Scotland. And then in Britain for the following year, he makes all kinds of close friendships, relationships, lifetime relationships in some cases with the British, Irish, Scottish anti-slavery movement. And he is treated like a very special, you know, some of them treated him like this exotic brown Black man from the United States, a former slave, like an exhibit they could go see. But on the other hand, some of them embraced him as dear friends. And he'd never experienced that before. And he encountered some, but only a small degree of overt racism around the British Isles. He certainly saw some of it. But when he arrived back in the U.S., he's an angry young black man because he's coming back into the hothouse of American racism. And the first speech, when he goes out on the stump, right after he gets back in 47, he is saying things like, and this is all in the book, he's saying things like, I have no country. I have no patriotism. My country hates me. I hate it back. At one point he says, I only look forward to seeing its constitution shattered into pieces. One of the radical abolitionists, Wendell Phillips, took him aside at one point and said, Fred, tone it down, man. You're going to lose the audience here. But he wasn't toning anything down. But what he was beginning to learn is how to harness, as you say, harness that power of anger and rage into arguments. Now, Douglass's life, though, is an interesting test, as it has been for so many other writers in history. How much can language change the world? How much can a writer speaker, however brilliant, change the world? How much does that writer speaker have to find ways also to harness events and harness political institutions, to harness the society somehow into this use of language to change the world? Our greatest writers have always had to ask this. They want to change. Every major writer wants to change something about their society or their world, but how much can they? Douglass is a fascinating story of examining that process, because he did have an enormous impact. I speculate in the book that number one, he may have been seen as an orator in particular, or heard, therefore, by more Americans than anyone else who ever lived in the 19th century, because his speaking tours were just ubiquitous all the time, year after year after year, right into old age, right up until the last year of his life. And also, I speculate in the book that he may have traveled more miles than any other American in this pursuit, except probably Mark Twain. And Twain went to Asia, so that's kind of, you know, cheating.
But room, I guess.
But he had this problem eventually of visibility and fame, which can be pleasurable but also perilous.
We should also say that era when he comes back is when he gave his speech about the 4th of July, which has I think, you know, resonated particularly in this era. But do you think just,
that speech, by the way, had its greatest month ever this summer. It was just being used everywhere. And
yes.
I was being interviewed 3 times a day about that speech during the week of 4th of July. There'd never been a week like that about Douglass, which is amazing.
I mean, in some ways, activists today, writers today, speakers today, doing that very thing, using the events of the moment to leverage. But do you think that dynamic, and this is more, I guess, a parallel do you think that dynamic of writers, I mean, the ability for him to be so dominant, and which is sort of shocking and somewhat, was also a function of the time? I mean, there are less people writing, and he is a really unique voice in that era of someone who was that well educated and that talented in oratory and writing, but also had been born a slave. Can that be replicated today, or what does it look like if it's?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. The replication of that today would be, the kid from nowhere. And this happens in America. It's rare, but the kid from nowhere with almost no education who nevertheless somebody, I mean, today it wouldn't be the kid without a single day in a school in his life. That just wouldn't happen today. Credentialing is just too important today. But it would be the kid from almost nowhere who manages to get into to get a decent education somehow. A teacher finds him, moves him on to this and to that. He gets into a college. He gets hooked on to, I don't know, this professor and that professor, and then maybe into a law school or something, or not. But who has an enormous talent, an artistic talent, a political talent, a linguistic talent. It still happens. I mean, there are these stories that still happen in America. And, you know, Barack Obama was not necessarily that person, given the kind of education he had, although, you know, he does come from obscurity. And manages to be bright enough to get sent first to a college in LA and then to Columbia and on and on and on. The rest is history. But he was a prodigy. Douglas was a prodigy. And there are aspects of his abilities and talents that are explainable. His abilities with language, I do deal with in the book. I mean, it comes very early. He has certain lucky breaks while he's a slave that introduces him to language and to the Bible and biblical storytelling and so on and so on. And I'm convinced he was, when he was both a child and then a teenager, like kids today, any kid, he found the one thing he was really good at, which was standing up and speaking, or, you know, he could read, and all of his fellow slave, his buddies, he called them his band of brothers. Male slaves, some of whom were younger, most of whom were older than him, they couldn't read or write. He had a special talent. And he found the one thing he was good at, and he just was going to get better and better at it. Just like today, a kid who can, you know, dribble between his legs and behind his back has got a start, you know, or a kid that can do science projects and is a prodigy. You know, this is what Douglas was, but he never set foot a day in his life in a real classroom. Now, nor did Abraham Lincoln, except for like a couple of years. So this, in the 19th century, this was all much more possible or likely than it ever would be today. But you got to also know here that this was the golden age of oratory. It was the only, great orators were the only game in town in the 19th century.
Right.
The Chautauqua circuit, you know, the lecture series. Ralph Waldo Emerson made his fame as much from his traveling lecture series as he did from writing his great essays. I mean, Emerson reached more auditors than he did readers. It's hard to imagine that about a writer like Emerson, whom we know now as the great essayist on the page, but he traveled all the time giving these lectures. So the person who could hold an audience for an hour or two out in a small town in Ohio or a village in Pennsylvania or, you know, upstate New York, was a hit and was needed. Now, and it was the slavery question above all else and the abolition movement above all else that spread information, spread reform movements more than anything. And the abolitionists made great use of the new modern technologies. And Douglas became very adept at all of them. First is transportation, the railroads. Second is the rotary press that made possible now weekly and daily newspapers. And then, of course, simply the voice. And in the book, I have many accounts, particularly from newspapers, of people describing Douglas as a speaker. It became a kind of, especially in the aftermath of the Civil War, it became a kind of wonder of the American world. If you could see Douglas, you know, Frederick Douglass is coming to town. Even if you didn't always agree with him, it was a thing.
Well, that's the part that sort of fascinates me, because you mentioned, you know, these other speakers in that golden era. You mentioned Barack Obama, who has sort of his story where he came out. But Douglas is a guy who is challenging sort of the fundamental building blocks of the country. And so
he wants to tear it down.
Right. I mean, does he achieve this level of celebrity and fame despite that? Or is the movement that's associated with that part of propelling him up?
It's both. I mean, the early abolitionist, and when he joins the movement in the early 1840s and right through the 40s into the 50s, abolitionists were extremely unpopular. Now, they had a following, of course. And there were sections of the North in which they were always safe and they had a following. There were towns that were known to be abolitionists and towns that were not. But they were notorious. Notorious. I mean, we don't have any firm statistics, but probably no more than 15% of the Northern population, this is in the free states by 1850 or so, was ever associated with any anti-slavery society. It meant the vast majority had nothing to do with abolitionism, in fact, hated it. But one of the techniques, directly to your question, one of the techniques he learned from the Garrisonian abolitionists who kind of brought him out on the circuit was to rile up an audience. The whole point of this was to stimulate your audience, to get your audience angry. Even if they threw a few tomatoes at you, that was success. Because you got their attention. The whole idea was to chastise as you instruct. It's a very Christian kind of message. It's an Old Testament, you know, Jeremiadic kind of technique. It's a preacher's technique. I'm going to call you to the altar now. I want to make you hurt. I'm going to make you look at your hypocrisy, which is what the great 4th of July speech does, among other things. And I'm going to get you angry. I'm going to trouble you. You're not going to like what you're going to hear here, but you might listen. That's what prophets do, by the way. Prophets are not, well, first of all, there aren't very many of them. And prophets are not usually just nice people you want to have lunch with.
Right.
They trouble you.
Let's turn a little bit to Reconstruction. I mean, my understanding of Reconstruction came so much from your work and from Eric Foner's. Uh-huh. But the idea of it being the second American Revolution, as you call it, mm-hmm. and you know, in many respects, I liken it to like Yavne for Judaism, like the rabbinic sure. Judaism that we practice today, that everybody perceives as Judaism, is actually sort of like version two.
Right.
And in many respects, the founding fathers that we have today were the ones who basically constructed. You know, the 14th Amendment and 13th and 15th, but the 14th. And what is the importance of understanding, of coming to that understanding?
Well, first of all, I love the Jewish or Hebrew prophetic analogy here, because it is the one Douglas used so much. The temple was destroyed. The temple in Jerusalem was destroyed, as the prophet said, because it had to be. The people had become so corrupt, so hopelessly poisoned by their own venality and hubris and all the rest. The temple was going to be destroyed and they were going to go into exile, and they may or may not find their way back. That's the great story of Exodus, right? Well, Douglas will interpret the Civil War in many ways through that lens, not exclusively, but so did so many other Americans for that matter. The Civil War and Reconstruction is the destruction of the first American Republic. And you don't need Frederick Douglass to tell you that. I mean, he does tell you that 1,000 times over. But Lincoln argued the same thing. What's the argument of the Gettysburg Address? Well, that short, you know, most well-known American speech, if people just look at it, there's Lincoln standing in that cemetery and saying, the 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. But he's saying that nation is being destroyed right here. We're burying the results of that destruction. And we have to imagine a new one. Now, he didn't have that all figured out yet, but he did actually use the word equality in that speech. He drew that off the Declaration of Independence. Now, Douglass and many others saw the Civil War as this reckoning that destroyed that first slaveholding republic of 80-some years. It did it in horrible bloodshed, but they found a way to argue that that was necessary bloodshed. That's an easy thing to say, not an easy thing to reap and to do. But out of it came this responsibility, at least among the leadership of that Republican Party, that had been founded back in the 1850s to resist the future of slavery, and they did. And they took the leadership anyway, took responsibility for the freedom of these 4 million slaves and for answering the question, now, who are they? What are they? The 13th Amendment says, before the war ever ends, slavery shall never exist. Any kind of involuntary servitude can never exist. The 14th Amendment, the most important of all, especially with Section 1, is the Equal Protection Clause. It's the Equality Before Law Clause. It's the Birthright Citizenship Clause. It's the Equality Clause of our Constitution. And the 15th, of course, is the Voting Rights Amendment, 1869-1870, which didn't go as far as the radicals like Douglas would have wanted because it didn't prevent qualifications tests of all kinds. But there it was now, the right to vote, at least for black men. This was a new constitution. This was defining the American Republic now in a wholly new way, a new inclusive way. It's saying it's being founded now on some degree of equality between the races, the ethnicities, the religions. And Douglas was right at the heart of this. This was Douglas's whole argument about what this Armageddon had been all about. And for about 4 to 5 to 6 years, depending on where you're standing, they reinvented the United States. But every great and it's a revolution, let's face it. There are different kinds of revolutions, aren't there? But every revolution always foments a counter-revolution. I mean, if it's important enough, there will be a reaction. And how we've seen this again and again and again. Well, what is Trumpism? But in some ways, a counter-revolution against the Obama presidency and against liberalism and against so many of the great changes of the 1960s. Even the so-called Reagan Revolution, which now gets viewed in sepia tones. The Reagan Revolution was a revolution against the 60s. It was against civil rights. It was against feminism. It was against all the rights movements. Anyway, the first great counter-revolution in American history was the White South's ability to revive under the reformed Democratic Party and through the uses of terror and violence, the worst levels of it we've ever seen in our history, the ability of the White South to revive in the 1870s, to take back control of their state governments, what they called Southern redemption, and then ultimately to defeat the Reconstruction governments and the Reconstruction laws and measures, and especially to defeat black suffrage, black voting, brought about eventually, essentially, an end to Reconstruction around 1877 and into the 1880s. And it made possible. It didn't happen overnight by any means, but it made possible the evolution then of a system of first de facto and then de jure segregation of the races, eventually into this elaborate system of Jim Crow laws and an American system, in effect, of racial apartheid.
And that counter-revolution lasted, well, I mean, it lasted in that form for decades.
Yeah, 70 years or so. It's it depends on when you date its beginning. I mean, the real Jim Crow system, at least in law, begins in the 1890s. I mean, in the 1890s, the first overt disfranchisement law passed by Mississippi. But by 1900, and especially by 1910, all of the ex-Confederate states have become completely Jim Crow societies, and so have other sections of the country, by the way, including in the North. And a part of this process all along has been extremely overt uses of discrimination and extremely overt uses of the denial of the right to vote, of voter fraud, and extremely brutal uses of terrorist violence.
The other day we had Susan Mettler on, who was talking about Wilmington, which I had never was not aware, which was horrific. And we
1898, I just reviewed a new book on that by David Zucchino. It's coming out in the New York Review of Books. It's incredible. Yeah, it's a story Americans need to know better, because it really was a white supremacist coup d'etat that took over the state of North Carolina, where an interracial coalition had held on quite well, thank you, in the 1890s. And black politicians were getting elected, especially in eastern North Carolina around Wilmington, for years. In fact, the only remaining black congressman in the United States at that point was from Wilmington, North Carolina. But the white supremacists of North Carolina got organized in 1898 and ran a... And they were so overt compared to today's vote suppressors and white supremacists. Would that our vote suppressors today were as honest as they were back then. Although they're getting more and more on it. They're beginning to say out loud the things they think.
I mean, well, one of the things that, you know, I think you've argued in your books is this notion of the Civil War, the shooting war ended, but in many respects, the fundamentals of what were driving that war has not. And, you know, I think back to just that notion of an ongoing counter-revolution and an ongoing revolution, and those moments where the revolution wins out seem very, very narrow in terms of time, right? And then there's these long stretches, because I'm quite convinced that you could draw a line from the Voting Rights Act in 65 to the Supreme Court in 2013, gutting Section 5.
Right.
And that is an uninterrupted sort of slow moving process. And we are still in that sort of that process now. And it's, you know, when we talk about, I mean, just this past week, the implications of the 13th and 14th and 15th amendments, when you look at what's going on in Florida, the disenfranchisement of felons, and then with the use of a poll tax.
Right.
I mean, that is a mirror. I mean, that is like almost like a tracing of what was going on 150 years ago in the sort of post-Reconstruction era.
Well, that's very well put, Sam. And I've said this in many places in print that, you know, we live with the legacies of Reconstruction around us every day. If for one thing, my lawyer friends tell me that close to 2/3 of all litigation in American courts at one point or another come around to 14th Amendment litigation. We are forever debating what equality before the law actually means in courts. Let's not forget Bush v. Gore, 5-4, when the Supreme Court chose our president, argued it on the basis of equal protection under the 14th Amendment for the state of Florida. I mean, and on we could go. Gay rights, gay marriage, on the other hand, from a different perspective, was a 14th Amendment decision. It was equality before the law. And John Roberts said, yeah, I guess they're right. so it's all around us. And then you take the issue of federalism. My goodness, we don't talk about that enough. We have a states' rights Supreme Court right now, and it's about to get even more so, perhaps. I mean, Clarence Thomas is the most states' rights Supreme Court justice since one of those Southerners in the late 19th century, which is so weird, but it's true. What is the proper relationship of federal power to state power? It's an eternal question in America. Now, the Civil War had a gigantic row over that, right? And we had, you know, people had a right, some people, Northerners who had won that war, had a right in, say, 1870, to think that, you know, states' rights had been really pretty well crushed here in the blood of Antietam or Gettysburg. But no, not at all. The Supreme Court, even with all the members appointed by Republican presidents, by 1883 is going to basically wipe out the 14th Amendment in the famous civil rights cases of 1883 and say that, no, this discrimination issue, whether it's a hotel or a train or wherever, it can only be settled at the state level. You know, which basically said, you know, the 14th Amendment doesn't mean anything. Anyway, again and again.
You mentioned Reagan. I mean, that's how Reagan launched his general campaign after the Republican convention was at the Neshoba County Fair talking about states' rights.
Exactly. And he went after unions, remember? He crushed the air traffic control unions and then other unions. And, you know, the anti-union movement in this country, the so-called right to work laws, are the uses. I mean, let's face it, the right wing in America has been very effective at using the language of the 14th Amendment, the language of equality, to fight against those very achievements in equality for women and black and brown and immigrant people and so on. They're very adept at that, to say the least.
Can I ask you one final question that's a little bit sort of like tangential, but the post office, obviously playing a very big role in all these questions about, you know, voting right now. The post office, like, this is another example of, and I think, you know, your work has sort of taught me more about the concept of history in many respects. Good.
That's the point of doing history, to just help us understand why it's so important.
Well, honestly, like that.
Why it's all around us.
I lament that it took me this long to sort of like understand that, but I guess it's.
You're doing very well, Eddie.
But the post office is also another issue that, like, there was so much fighting in it was the radical Republicans who, you know, sort of like gave birth to this notion of the post office and its ubiquitiness, I guess.
Yeah.
And we're still, it's still a contention on some level.
You know, it's given me a renewed joy when I walk into a post office. You know, sometimes it's it's boring. It's something you have to do. You got to get some stamps. You got to mail something. But by God, it's a democratic institution. You know, it's one place almost all of us use. Now, not as much anymore because of FedEx and the internet and Amazon. But even Amazon uses it. the Postal Service guys deliver Amazon packages all day, every day. And an attack on that is just yet another way. Let's be honest about this. Higher voter turnout serves one of America's political parties. Lower voter turnout serves another of America's political parties. And the one wanting lower voter turnout is doing everything it can possibly do to suppress the turnout of Americans to vote. They are doing it because they've seen the demographics, and the demographics have scared the hell out of them. One third of all the votes cast this election will be cast by African Americans, Asian Americans, and Hispanic Americans. And those numbers are growing like crazy every year. The number of the voter turnout among young people in 2018 was unprecedented. Republicans, given the fact that they have become essentially the white people's party, are in trouble. They're fighting against, they're colliding with modernity again. And they're against most of the great changes of modernity. They can't even bring themselves to believe in climate change, until they get burned in a forest, I guess. So we're living in the post office. It became this visible example. Do you remember when the delivery service had a strike?
UPS.
UPS, sorry. You know, those guys won their strike that year. Because people love UPS, it turns out. They love having things delivered by UPS. And people got behind them because they were a service that people tended to rely on and even love. The UPS guy in his brown shorts walks up, he's your friend. So, you know, there's a sense in which the right in America is fighting against modernity itself. Now, they win sometimes because they can manage the rules, and sometimes they win because of ideology in some cases. But they're up against a demographic phenomenon that is not on their side. So I have a new piece coming out in Actually, it's in Die Zeit, the German weekly. They asked me to write a fairly long historical piece on voter suppression, the history of voter suppression. And that's coming out, I think, next week. It's just amazing the measures, the methods that Republicans have turned to. And by the way, the template for that is Reconstruction, too. I mean, there are all kinds of things that were methods that were used to keep Black people from voting. Actually, in Reconstruction, though, they ultimately just used guns.
Well, David Blight, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming on. We will put a link to Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, on majority.fm, and also a link to your audio course on the Civil War, which covers Reconstruction and, of course, the sort of the post-Reconstruction era. It's been such an important work in my understanding of so many things. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks so much, Sam. Thanks for having me. I should update that lecture series sometime because the jokes are getting old, I think.
Well, they still work. They still fly. It was, but I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Emma, what did you think? Was I right? One of the best ofs? I mean, it would absolutely have been better had you been there, but I mean, with that caveat in mind?
Well, absolutely. I think what you're talking about is super important, right? The idea of our history being taught by these punctuated moments, like wars, and there's never discussion of what comes after and what's important to building the fabric of the nation. So, I mean, I think it's brilliant.
This guy, and again, I know I brought it up during the course of the interview, but if you have, 15 hours, I think it is. How long was it, Brendan? Brendan was the one who told me about it, and I'm forever grateful. But David Blight's course on the Reconstruction was put on audio, I guess, I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago, and it is worth listening to the entire thing, probably on multiple times. We've got a great week for you coming up of our best ofs. We are hoping that you stayed safe and are staying safe and hanging in there as COVID, of course, is raging across the country. And, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It may be a couple of months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months away, but it is there, folks. So take care of yourselves. We will be back tomorrow with a fascinating look at the role of the United Nations. And I have to admit, it has, I feel a little disillusioned after this interview that we did with Stephen Wertheim, but it is a fascinating look at the formation of the United Nations and its role in our world. Emma, until tomorrow.
See you later.
Okay, we'll see you tomorrow, folks.